Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you 60 minutes of news, information, and commentary about the African American community. This week, I'll have seven reading selections, including one about a rodeo from the Kansas City Star newspaper, some health data from the website Health Daily News, a story about the growing interest in Buddhism from the Religion News Service, the obituaries of Tony Brown and Khadijah Farrakhan from the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune. I'll wrap up with a reading connected to America's semi-quincentennial from the New York Times. And I'm starting with this. Lauryn Hill honored, Janet Jackson stuns Teyana Taylor, and Drewski makes history at BET Awards. This was written by Jonathan Landrum and published June 29, 2026, at the Associated Press's AP.com website. After watching a 20-minute tribute celebrating her groundbreaking career, Lauryn Hill surprised the BET Awards audience Sunday, June 28th, with an impromptu performance of her 1998 classic, X Factor, after accepting the Living Legend Icon Award before closing the show with Everything Is Everything. Introduced by Ice Cube, the 8-time Grammy winner was honored with performances at Los Angeles' Peacock Theater from SZA, Doechii, Lizzo, Queen Latifah, Common, her children Salah Marley and Zion Marley, who revisited songs from Hill's stellar catalog while she stood smiling, singing along, and applauding throughout the tribute. After she accepted the honor, Hill encouraged artists to embrace their gifts and remain true to their purpose. "I fight for y'all," Hill said. "And fighting for y'all is me fighting for myself. It's me fighting for my children. It's me fighting for my community." The Living Legend Icon Award recognizes pioneers whose work has remained culturally essential across generations. Hill first emerged as a member of the Fugees before releasing her landmark solo debut, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, featuring classics including Doo Wop, That Thing, X Factor, and Everything Is Everything. The next part of the article is titled, Janet Jackson Surprises Teyana Taylor. Teyana Taylor fought back tears Sunday after an emotional surprise at the BET Awards. Janet Jackson walked onto the stage to present Taylor with the Icon of the Year Award. Taylor, visibly stunned as Jackson received a standing ovation, embraced the music legend before thanking one of her biggest inspirations. "They did not tell me Janet was coming," Taylor said through tears. "There will be no me without you." Presenting the award, Jackson praised Taylor's relentless work ethic and artistic range, highlighting her Golden Globe win for Best Supporting Actress in one battle after another, and calling her gifts God-given. The Icon of the Year Award recognizes a creative force whose influence is shaping culture. Taylor has evolved from a multi-platinum recording artist into an award-winning actor, director, producer, and choreographer. Accepting the honor, Taylor reflected on her two-decade career. The BET Awards paused to honor influential figures from music and entertainment who died over the past year during an emotional in memoriam tribute. Erica Campbell of Mary Mary introduced the segment by reflecting on the enduring legacies left behind by those who died, paying special tribute to the late gospel composer Richard Smallwood, whose music, she said, strengthened her faith. She also remembered the late music executive Clive Davis, who died earlier this week at 94, before performing Whitney Houston's I Love the Lord with LaAndrea Johnson. The tribute remembered Smallwood, Davis, Malcolm Jamal Warner, and others whose contributions left a lasting mark on music, television, and culture. The show also celebrated the late D'Angelo's legacy with a star-studded tribute that opened with appearances by his three children, Ari Lennox, BJ the Chicago Kid, Duran Bernard. George Clinton and Ray were among the artists who honored the singer with performances of his music, celebrating the enduring influence of one of R&B's most acclaimed voices. Music executive Sylvia Rhone received the BET Ultimate Icon Award in recognition of her groundbreaking leadership and lasting impact on the music industry. Presented by Kelly Rowland, the honor celebrated Rhone's trailblazing career as the first black woman to lead a major record company owned by a Fortune 500 corporation. A video tribute featured messages from artists including Missy Elliott and Busta Rhymes, highlighting her role in helping develop the careers of performers such as Tracy Chapman, Brandy, Erykah Badu, Lil Wayne, Kid Cudi, Future, Travis Scott, and Tyler, the Creator. While accepting the award, Rhone dedicated the honor to the artist and creative team she has worked alongside throughout her career. "Tonight's honor bears my name, but it really belongs to all of us who create culture," she said. Rhone also used the moment to urge the music industry to protect artists as artificial intelligence reshapes the business. "We make the algorithm. The algorithm doesn't make us," she said. "We must honor the musician. We must compensate the creator." She concluded by calling on the industry to ensure the next generation of artists has the opportunity to create the songs that will change the world. Drewski made a grand entrance to kick off the BET Awards on Sunday, descending from the rafters in a harness as a choir filled the theater with a rendition of Kirk Franklin's Revolution, setting the tone for a night celebrating music, comedy, and culture. The comedian and digital creator made history by becoming the youngest host of the ceremony. The show's opening performances featured Kalani, who sang Folded with Jamie Foxx and his daughter, Annalise Estelle Foxx, on guitar. Dan Tolliver also performed his hits E85 and Body. That was the article titled, "Lauryn Hill Honored, Janet Jackson Stuns Teyana Taylor, and Drewski Makes History at BET Awards." This was written by Jonathan Landrum and published June 29, 2026, in the Associated Press's AP.com website. My next reading is titled, "Families and First-Timers Creating New Traditions at Second Annual Kansas City Black Rodeo." This was written by J.M. Banks and published August 2, 2026, in the Kansas City Star newspaper. Families filled Hale Arena as the Kansas City Invitational Black Rodeo returned for its second year, with parents carrying toddlers in cowboy boots, children proudly wearing brand new cowboy hats, and relatives stopping to take photos dressed in full Western attire. The second annual event, presented by the Southeastern Rodeo Association, expanded from two performances to three after demand exceeded expectations during its inaugural year in Kansas City. Last year's tickets sold out weeks before the event, leaving many families unable to attend. This year, organizers added another performance, giving more people the opportunity to experience a tradition that had been absent from the city for years. For Tamara Alvarado, attending this year's rodeo was an opportunity she had been waiting for after missing last year's sold-out event. She brought her 2-year-old daughter, Sophia, hoping to introduce her to a part of Black history and culture that she believes deserves greater visibility. "I'm here to celebrate Black heritage," Alvarado said. "I am super excited to share with my daughter Black cowgirls and cowboys." For many first-time visitors, the rodeo represented more than entertainment. It offered parents an opportunity to introduce their children to a part of American history that is often overlooked. Throughout the afternoon, parents pointed toward competitors and explained that Black cowboys and cowgirls have long been part of the American West. "If we don't see them, we forget that we have great deep connections to them," Alvarado said. "We assume that it's somebody else's culture, but we are definitely deeply rooted in being cowboys and cowgirls in all things with cattle and agriculture." As families made their way through the venue, vendor booths selling cowboy hats, boots, and Western apparel remained busy before the show. Parents helped children pick out their first cowboy hats while others stopped for food before entering the arena. Inside, children danced to music from the DJ before settling into their seats, many preparing to watch a rodeo for the very first time. Throughout the afternoon, children leaned forward as young riders entered the arena for roping events, barrel racing, and other competitions. Many parents were surprised to learn some competitors were only 10 or 12 years old, making the sport feel more attainable for the children watching from the stands. Michelle Rico brought her nearly 4-year-old daughter, Soliana, after being invited by her cousin Alvarado. Like many families attending, she viewed the rodeo as an opportunity to expose her daughter to something entirely new while spending time together. Before arriving, she purchased her first cowboy hat specifically for the occasion. As the competitions unfolded, Rico found herself just as captivated as her daughter. Seeing children compete in rodeo events was something she had never realized was possible, and it gave her daughter role models she could relate to. I just wanted to give her an opportunity to see black excellence in a different way than she normally does, Rico said. I didn't know that kids competed in the rodeo. It's giving my daughter something to look up to. It's amazing. For Walter Hull, the founder and chief executive officer of the Southeastern Rodeo Association, those reactions from families were exactly why bringing the rodeo back to Kansas City matters. He said the city had gone years without a black rodeo before last year's return, creating anticipation among families eager to reconnect with a tradition that had long been missing. Hall believes the event gives children the opportunity to see themselves reflected in a sport many people still do not associate with black history. While television and movies have often portrayed the American cowboy one way, he said black cowboys have always been an important part of that story. A lot of people don't think that black cowboys exist, which we do, Hull said. It's just important for people to see people like us in the arena, and it helps young kids know that there are black cowboys. You may have the next world champion sitting in the stand. He may think, if he can do it, I can too. So that may encourage him to go out and practice. Behind the scenes, competitors greeted one another like extended family after traveling the rodeo circuit together throughout the year. For Chase Pierre of Houston, rodeo has always been a family tradition. His grandfather introduced him to the sport as a toddler, and today he is passing that tradition on to his children. His daughter already competes in barrel racing, while his 2-year-old son has already begun riding horses. Pierre believes rodeo teaches lessons that extend far beyond competition. Caring for horses every day instills responsibility, patience, and discipline, values he hopes his children carry throughout their lives. It's values and morals to get up every morning, feed your horse, water your horse, taking care of it, Pierre said. You can't just go out there, don't feed it, and then expect the horse to perform. Give them something else to see, he said. You ain't gotta be from the country to be country. You can always be country. The country will welcome you with open arms. As families filtered out of the Hale Arena following the afternoon performance, many children still wore the cowboy hats they had picked out before the show. Some pretended to rope cattle as they galloped toward the parking lot, while parents like Alvarado and Rico talked about returning next year with more family members. I want her to see that black people can do many different things, Alvarado said. We have connections to all parts of American culture, including being cowboys and cowgirls. That was the article titled, Families and First-Timers Creating New Traditions at Second Annual Kansas City Black Rodeo. This was written by J.M. Banks and published August 2, 2026 in the Kansas City Star newspaper. My next reading is titled, Black Americans Born Abroad Have Lower Odds for Stroke Study Finds. This was written by Shawnee Brucey and published July 17, 2026 at the website Health Day News. Country of birth can play a part in black Americans' stroke risk, according to a new study. The study, published July 15 in Neurology, found that despite black Americans typically having an overall higher risk of stroke compared to folks from other racial and ethnic groups, that risk changes based on the country where they are born. A review of federal survey data from 64,717 adults identifying as black found that those born outside the United States had a lower odds of stroke than those born in the U.S. Researchers noted that 2,549 people surveyed reported having had a stroke. Of those, 4.3% were born in the United States, 1.5% in the Caribbean or South and Central America, and 0.8% in Africa. Adjusting for lifestyle factors that include age, smoking, and income levels, researchers found that black Americans born in Africa had a 57% lower risk of stroke. Those born in the Caribbean or South and Central America had a 53% lower risk. Those who had immigrated in the last 15 years had a 73% lower risk of a stroke. Our study suggests a healthy immigrant effect in which recent immigrants are healthier than the general population. Study author Dr. Alejandro Vargas of Rush University Medical Center in Chicago said in a news release, "This may be due to differences in stroke risk factors such as high blood pressure or stress." But, he said, people who identify as black are often treated as a single category of people, which can overlook differences related to birthplace and immigration status. Vargas, a fellow of the American Academy of Neurology, added that grouping all racial and ethnic populations together can hide important health trends and hinder efforts to create targeted interventions. The study also identified other factors that doctors can consider when determining stroke risk. For example, among the black stroke survivors, the U.S.-born individuals had higher levels of smoking and obesity and lower levels of college education. They were also younger, demonstrating that lifestyle can play a significant role in stroke risk. That was the article, "Black Americans Born Abroad Have Lower Odds for Stroke," study finds. This was written by Shani Brucey and published July 17, 2026, at the website of Health Day News. Next, the first of two obituaries. The first remembrance is titled, "Tony Brown, host of public affairs show aimed at black audiences, dies at 93. This was written by Joseph Berger and published June 27, 2026. Tony Brown, the pioneering host and producer of Tony Brown's Journal, a long-running public affairs television show aimed at black audiences that was notable for its candid and often contentious discussions about race and other politically charged issues, died on June 17th at his home in Newport News, Virginia. He was 93. Mr. Brown's death from coronary heart disease was announced on Friday, June 26th, on his Facebook page. By the time his PBS show went off the air in 2008, Mr. Brown estimated that over the course of nearly four decades, he had interviewed more than 1,000 guests, including Lena Horne, Jesse Jackson, Angela Davis, Bill Cosby, and Sammy Davis Jr. While he had no favorites, he said he singled out an exchange with Ms. Horne that not only captured the frankness that his program encouraged, but also hinted at his broadcasting mission. He recalled asking the well-known singer why she had married a white man, the composer and conductor Lenny Hayton. And her reply, "I was not woman enough at that time to marry a black man. As a woman, I should have been looking at myself first." An intense and impeccably dressed former social worker with hardscrabble West Virginia roots, who was blessed with a silken baritone, Mr. Brown acknowledged that he made programming decisions on the basis of one thing: will it help black people? He told the Congressional Black Caucus at a hearing in 1972 that the exclusion of black people from executive jobs in the media had led to a totally brainwashed black population, drilled to think like whites, resulting in a general disrespect and misunderstanding by whites about blacks and blacks about themselves. To remedy the situation, he urged that public broadcasting stations assemble staffs that resembled the ethnic makeup of their audiences. 2 years earlier, after a brief stint at Detroit's public television station WTVS, Mr. Brown had moved to New York City to become the executive producer and host of an award-winning monthly public TV show called Black Journal. Mr. Brown's bluntness and flair for broadcasting enhanced the ratings, and soon it had a weekly slot on the schedule. An interview with Mr. Davis offered an example of the uncommon insights that viewers came to expect. The entertainer, known for his chumminess with white celebrities like Frank Sinatra and other members of the Rat Pack, shared stories of the racism he had experienced in the army and on the road, where hotels refused to put him up for the night. He also experienced regret for working so hard at emulating white stars. In 1995, 5 million viewers were tuning in each week to the program, which had been renamed after its host. Mr. Brown's provocative show was not universally well received. A 1971 episode on the prison experiences of Miss Davis and the Soledad brothers, three black inmates of a facility in Soledad, California, who were accused of killing a guard, was criticized by the New York Times television critic John J. O'Connor, who cited a failure to present counterpoints from white officials or prison guards and an assumption that all black inmates were political prisoners. Mr. O'Connor also criticized an episode on the roots of white racism in Christianity, in which one speaker contended that Jesus was black and another claimed that there were no white Madonnas in European churches until the 16th or 17th centuries. Mr. Brown countered that his intention was to show positive images of black people rather than images that fed into white stereotypes of the black community. When the public television station WNET planned to air a Swedish documentary that portrayed a Harlem overpopulated with prostitutes, drug peddlers, and street hustlers, Mr. Brown organized civic groups and black station employees in protest, arguing that a bigoted sector of white America will have its prejudices frozen in place and reinforced. The documentary was pulled from the schedule. Another Times television critic, Jack Gould, suggested that the show's value lay in educating whites about the black perspective, and Mr. Brown responded angrily. Racism is a big, powerful white establishment newspaper setting up a white television god system, interpreting to black people what they have seen on a program produced for blacks, by blacks, and about blacks, he wrote in a letter published in the Times in 1970. Over time, Mr. Brown and his program mellowed, and many years later, Mr. O'Connor admonished him again, but this time from the opposite standpoint, saying that Mr. Brown's show had shifted from being militant and abrasive to being a black version of The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson, complete with segments on fashion by black designers. By 1982, Mr. Brown was giving President Ronald Reagan a platform to trumpet the number of black men and women in his administration. In a newspaper interview the same year, Mr. Brown seemed pleased that the program had three white viewers for every black viewer. And by 1991, he revealed that he had joined the Republican Party because he supported its basic concept of market economy and self-help, while Democrats had a philosophy of dependence on government. A mentality of affirmative action and civil rights is not going to get you anywhere in the 21st century, he told Michael Marriott of the Times in 1995. If you believe that you're going to be a leader in the world, if white people are going to have a preference program for you, brother, you just get out your cotton-picking clothes, because that's what you're going to be doing. In line with his advocacy for self-reliant black capitalism, he set up a council in 1985 that encouraged African Americans to patronize merchants of their own race. Eventually, he began publishing self-help books, among them, Empower, a seven-step plan to overthrow the conspiracy that is stealing your money and freedom, 1998, and What Mama Taught Me, The Seven Core Values of Life, 2003. He also praised his employer, Channel 13, in a video posted on the station's website for enabling remarkable progress for black, Latino, and Asian members of staff. Recalling the monochromatic makeup of television when he began his career, he said, I never dreamed I'd work in television. William Anthony Brown was born in Charleston, West Virginia on April 11, 1933, the youngest of five children of Royal and Catherine Brown. His father left before he was born, he told the Times in 1995, and from the age of 2 months, he was raised by Elizabeth Sanford and her daughter, Mabel Holmes, two women who weren't relatives but were concerned about his welfare. He referred to them as angels in the dedication of his 1995 book, Black Lies, White Lies, The Truth According to Tony Brown. By the time he was 12, they had died and he was once again living with his mother. A complete list of Mr. Brown's survivors is not immediately available. In school, he excelled in English and drama and struggled to overcome his shyness by reading the works of Shakespeare on a local radio broadcast. He enlisted in the Army in 1953 and then studied at Wayne State University in Detroit, receiving a bachelor's degree in sociology in 1959 and later a master's degree in psychiatric social work. In June 1963, Mr. Brown helped organize a march in Detroit led by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. that some regarded as a dress rehearsal for the March on Washington 2 months later. The same year, he began working for the Detroit Courier, a predominantly black newspaper, eventually serving as its drama critic and city editor. In 1968, he moved to Detroit's public television station, where he worked as a programmer and produced the station's first show for African Americans, Colored People's Time. When William Greaves, a host and executive producer of Black Journal, left in 1970 to make films, Mr. Brown was brought in to replace him. At the time, there were only a few nationally broadcast shows aimed at black audiences. When the show was renamed Tony Brown's Journal in 1977, Mr. Brown made a deal with PepsiCo to sponsor it, and it was syndicated on commercial television for some 19 years, at one point appearing on 80 stations. Mr. Brown served as the first dean of the Howard University School of Communications from 1971 to 1974, until holding both jobs proved onerous. For a while, he also wrote a weekly column syndicated in 130 newspapers and hosted a call-in radio show 4 times a week on WLIB-AM. During his time as the host of Tony Brown's Journal, he encouraged the development of black production talent, he said, partly because he recognized the potency of the media in transforming the image and self-images of African Americans. Once we break the back of television as an insidious one-eyed monster that teaches us to hate ourselves, he told the Times in 1970, we will break the back of white racism. That was the obituary titled, Tony Brown, host of public affairs show aimed at black audiences, dies at 93. This was written by Joseph Berger and published June 27, 2026, in the New York Times newspaper. My next obituary is from the Chicago Tribune newspaper. It's titled, Mother Khadija Farrakhan, wife of Louis Farrakhan, dies at 90. This was written by Bob Goldsborough and published July 2, 2026. Khadija Farrakhan spent decades as the mother of the faithful for the adherents of the Nation of Islam, working closely with her husband, Louis, to rebuild the Chicago-based religious organization in the late 1970s, she handled a vast array of duties including overseeing accounting, designing uniforms worn at mosques, and later devising children's programming for the group's annual Savior's Day holiday. What I remember most about her is her spirit. Her spirit was just so wonderful, and her smile was contagious, said the Reverend Michael Flager, senior pastor at St. Sabina Catholic Church on the South Side, a longtime friend. She had a smile that when you saw her, the whole room lit up. You just felt her presence. And she had a gentleness about her, but also a strength about her. Farrakhan, 90, died of natural causes on June 27th at a hospital in Michigan City, Indiana, said Ishmael Mohammed, the Nation of Islam's national assistant minister. A longtime resident of the Southside Kenwood neighborhood, she also owned a farm in New Buffalo, Michigan. Born Betsy Ross in Boston in 1935, Farrakhan grew up in a Catholic family in Boston's Lower Roxbury area. In the middle of Louis Farrakhan's first year of college in North Carolina, he met Betsy. And after that, it was always Betsy, Betsy, Betsy. He never made time for anyone else, and he never looked at anyone else. Louis Farrakhan's classmate, Clarence Jones, told biographer Arthur Magida in the 1996 book, Prophet of Rage, A Life of Louis Farrakhan and His Nation. Homesick and missing Betsy, Louis Farrakhan chose to leave college in the summer of 1953, instead announcing he would marry Betsy, who by that time was pregnant. The couple wed on September 12, 1953, in St. Cyprian's Church in Boston, where her husband had served as an acolyte as a boy. In 1955, the young family attended the Nation of Islam Savior Day Convention in Chicago. Betsy rose to join the organization when there was a call for acceptance at the end of the convention, even before her husband did. Dawn Marie Gibson wrote in her 2023 biography, The Ministry of Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam. Betsy's decision to join the Nation of Islam independently of her husband is noteworthy and indicates that she was one of thousands of women to do so, Gibson wrote. Joining the Nation of Islam, Betsy Ross first changed her surname to X. According to the Nation of Islam's newspaper, The Final Call, Louis Farrakhan gave her the name Khadija, after the first wife of the Muslim prophet Muhammad. Nation of Islam leader Elijah Muhammad gave Khadija and Louis, who was born Louis Walcott, the surname Farrakhan. Some have written that Farrakhan is a variation of an Arabic word meaning the criterion, while Louis Farrakhan said in interviews and sermons that he did not know what the name meant because Muhammad never told him. In the years after Malcolm X's assassination, Louis Farrakhan advanced within the Nation of Islam, moving from Boston to New York City to Chicago. After Muhammad's death in 1975, the group foundered. In 1977, when the Farrakhans decided to rebuild the Nation of Islam, Khadija Farrakhan assumed a key role as the organization's first secretary, effectively its chief financial officer. She also edited and managed the production of The Final Call. When Louis Farrakhan began having meetings, when he began collecting charity, and when he began having financial responsibilities, when those things happened, the person responsible for ensuring that every dime, nickel, and penny was accounted for was Mother Khadija. And Louis said personally from the rostrum that there was never a time when 1 cent was off while she served as Secretary of the Nation of Islam, said Saad Ali Mohammed, the organization's current national secretary. I thought that was very important because when you're talking about the rebuilding, Louis was responsible and functioned for the spiritual word, while the management of the Nation of Islam quite honestly began with her with respect to the financial resources. A trained seamstress, Farrakhan was responsible for the designs of the clothing worn by women in the Nation of Islam, such as the white uniform worn for mosque services, Ismail Muhammad said. Over the ensuing decades, as the Nation of Islam gained momentum, Farrakhan became known both as the group's first lady and as Mother of the Faithful, Ismail Muhammad said. That's the title her husband gave her, because as the wife to a spiritual leader and teacher, she had the role not just as a wife, but she was intimately involved in the nurturing and cultivation of faith of both the men and women who came to accept God and his religion, he said. In 1997, along with Winnie Mandela, Farrakhan spoke at the Million Woman March in Philadelphia, a gathering of black women modeled after the Million Man March that had occurred in Washington 2 years earlier. She had that quiet strength, but she knew how not to be quiet if she had to, recalled former Alderman Dorothy Tillman. She was very quiet, but also very supportive of her husband, and I would think having her as a wife gave him the strength to rebuild the nation. So she played a major role in that, and she always had a lot of concern for the women and the children. And she was a real helpmate. I loved Sister Khadija. She was loving and she had strength, and she was really the strength behind the minister Louis Farrakhan. In the early 2000s, Farrakhan created children's programming dubbed Mother Khadija's Children's Village for the organization's annual Savior's Day event, which usually is held in Chicago. Until then, there had been no children's programming at the celebration. That was a major part of her contribution to the Nation of Islam in recent years, Ismail Muhammad said. She came up with activities that children could enjoy to celebrate the founder of the Nation of Islam, and Mother Khadija's Children's Village was both educational and offered interactive activities along with some of the spiritual lessons that are given to the young Muslims. In a statement, Farrakhan's daughter, Maria, called her mother my first teacher, my first example of faith, my first best friend, and my first glimpse of what a woman of God truly looked like. In addition to her husband and her daughter Maria, Farrakhan is survived by 2 sons, Mustafa and Abnar. 4 other daughters, Betsy Jean, Donna, Fatima, and Kalada, and many grandchildren and great-grandchildren. That was the obituary, Mother Khadija Farrakhan, wife of Louis Farrakhan, dies at 90. written by Bob Goldsborough and published in the Chicago Tribune newspaper on July 2, 2026. My next reading is from the Religion News Service, and it's titled, Black American Buddhism is Growing in Visibility and Scholarship. This was written by Chloe Landon and published July 24, 2026. This article has been abbreviated for time. When Pamela Ayo Yetunde began hospice volunteering with an organization that utilizes mindfulness to help patients confront their own deaths, she was already far removed from her Methodist upbringing and on a quest for peace of mind. At the same time, she was reading the book Touching Peace by the influential Buddhist monk Chik Han. Shortly thereafter, she began sitting for meditation retreats. Those introductions to Buddhism changed the trajectory of her life. Yetunde has been a Buddhist for 24 years and is an accomplished pastoral counselor, educator, and author of several works, notably contributing to Black and Buddhist, What Buddhism Can Teach Us About Race, Resilience, Transformation, and Freedom. Yetunde told the Religion News Service that many Black people are increasingly drawn to deeply practice Buddhism, in part because it lacks the guilt and shame-based practices and beliefs common in Christian traditions. Long overlooked and newly energized, Black Buddhism is emerging as a movement and academic field to rewrite the history of Buddhism in the United States, a history that has overlooked the role of Black practitioners and intellectuals for more than a century, scholars argue. In early August, Princeton University will host a 4-day Black Buddhism faculty training workshop that aims to foster generative conversation among scholars of African American religion and Buddhism, and develop resources to teach about Black Buddhism in their classrooms. The workshop is sponsored by Princeton's Black Buddhism Faculty Project, BBFP, launched in 2023. The initiative draws attention to the growing study of Black Buddhism, which it describes as a boundary-crossing field in its bridging of scholars across Buddhist studies, American religions, African-American studies, and comparative literature and philosophy. Black Buddhism, as a self-identified movement, emerged in the 1990s and accelerated after the 2020 Black Lives Matter reckoning, when some Buddhists began engaging in conversations about race and karma and held meditation retreats specifically for people of color, said Adiana McNichol, an assistant professor of religious studies at Vanderbilt and part of Princeton's BBFP. Most historians trace the origins of Buddhism in the United States to the mid-19th century gold rush, when Chinese laborers and immigrants arrived on the West Coast and in Hawaii. Buddhism's national presence only expanded in the late 19th century with the arrival of Japanese immigrants, but scholars say that isn't the whole story. Black people have been engaging with Buddhist thought and ideas for nearly as long as Buddhism has been in the United States, said McNichol, who is writing a book about her research on the history of Black Buddhism and Afro-Asian solidarity. Jonathan Gold, a professor of Buddhist studies and the director of Princeton's Center for Culture, Society, and Religion, of which the BBFP is a part, said those behind the initiative hope to strengthen the academic knowledge of Black Buddhism. The faculty contend Buddhism is fundamental to American religious history and intersects meaningfully with African American religious history. Buddhist ideas, figures, and tenets, particularly the commitment to nonviolence, played an important role in the long civil rights movement, spanning from the end of Reconstruction to the late 1960s, said Ralph Craig III, an assistant professor of religion at Whitman College who was involved in Princeton's project. Influential Black thinkers like W.E.B. Du Bois, Howard Thurman, and Bayard Rustin engaged with various Eastern philosophies and Asian anti-colonial movements. Notably, Black civil rights leaders meaningfully interacted with Hindu leader Mahatma Gandhi, who drew inspiration from the Buddhist approach to nonviolence and transformed it into a tool of political resistance. Later, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. developed a close friendship with Nat Han, the Buddhist monk who once told King that some referred to him as a bodhisattva, or an enlightened being. Buddhist ideas trickled down to broader African American public places, influencing black newspapers, the musical world of jazz, new religious movements, and other cultural products, Craig said. It's not necessarily just because they happened to pick up a book in a bookstore and it blew their minds, right? There is a kind of circulation of ideas that's happening, Craig added. By the end of the 20th century, Buddhism had become more familiar to Americans and was promoted by many celebrities, including the Queen of Rock and Roll, Tina Turner. Despite its historical presence and popularity, only 1% of U.S. adults identify as Buddhist today. Of that population, a majority were born outside the United States, and nearly 60% are Asian, a quarter are white, and only 3% are black. Yet McNichol cautioned against taking survey results at face value. It's limiting if we just assume that religious identity is equivalent to formal professions of faith or attendance, she said, adding that those who engage in practices like Buddhist meditation but wouldn't necessarily call themselves Buddhists get left out. Black Buddhists like Yetunde say the tradition continues to grow and is appealing to many black Americans in its offering of a radical acceptance not easily found within other U.S. religious traditions. You can be a black woman. That was the article, Black American Buddhism is Growing in Visibility and Scholarship. This was written by Chloe Landon and published July 24, 2026. My final selection is related to America's semi-quincentennial. It's titled, The Fight to Fight, Black Soldiers in the Revolutionary War. This was written by Lizzie Skernick and published July 2, 2026 in the New York Times newspaper. The subtitle to the story is, Across New England, a writer traveled down dirt paths and into historic homes to find the forgotten stories of the enslaved men who fought for freedom on two fronts. In the run-up to the Battle of Bunker Hill, some 1,500 newly minted Minutemen were bivouacked in Massachusetts at Harvard University. Buildings were stuffed to the gills, soldiers spilling into barracks, and where students now crisscross Harvard Yard stood a row of privies and slaughterhouses. Every tree for miles had been cut down for fuel, giving the colonial troops a clear view of their enemy across Boston Harbor. According to recent research, some 10% of these troops were black. The history of abolition in New England has tended to obscure the region's equally robust history of slavery. In Massachusetts, sprawling mansions down Brattle Street in Cambridge were funded by plantations in Antigua. Churches in Andover had balconies where enslavers forced their captives to worship. In Newport, Rhode Island, an enslaved child could be purchased for gallons of rum, and white citizens traded humans along with copper kettles. The black Americans who fought for our country emerged from that world, living in postcard pretty New England settings. These New England captives lived lives of genteel terror. Separated from their spouses, children sold or simply given away, their lives were as circumscribed as the narrow back stairs they took from the kitchen to the attic, blazing in summer, bone-chilling in winter. When war with Britain was declared, these black Americans faced a choice that was not really a choice: either fight for their enslavers or stake their futures on an impetuous promise, Lord Dunmore, a loyalist governor who had not bothered to free the people he enslaved, offered freedom to indentured servants and people enslaved by patriots who joined His Majesty's troops. About 20,000 black soldiers did just that. They fought for the British in what Dunmore called his Ethiopian regiment. The most famous of these men is Colonel Tye, T-Y-E, of New Jersey, who harassed the Continental Army in raids across Monmouth County after escaping his brutal Quaker enslaver. Meanwhile, 5 to 10,000 black men fought for the Americans. Some were forced to fight alongside their enslavers. Some were sent in their enslaver's place. Many, in the chaotic wake of the war, self-emancipated. Some of their feats were so impressive that we remember them to this day. Peter Salem of Framingham, Massachusetts, mortally wounded Major John Pitcairn on Bunker Hill. Salem Poor of Andover was known by his peers as a brave and gallant soldier. Their heroism did not guarantee their liberty. The few who gained freedom still struggled to find work, to buy land, to build wealth. Free black veterans were forced to live on the fringes of their communities in poorhouses or on unprofitable land. They were denied pensions. Their lives were still circumscribed by laws that punished them for their race. The fight for freedom was far from over. When I was a preteen in Massachusetts, trudging through old Sturbridge Village and the battlefields of Lexington and Concord with my multiracial family, history guides didn't tell tales of black people's bravery. But as an adult, I came to realize that there must be more to our story. So in April, wearing inappropriate footwear, I had forgotten that in a New England spring, you should dress for all four seasons. I set out on a journey to better understand the lives of black soldiers during the Revolutionary War. I found historians, museums, and scholars working to resurrect this history and to offer a fuller picture of the fight for and the contradictions of American independence. After all, I already knew the worst part of the story. The founders of so-called commitment to liberty did not include us. The next part of the article is titled, The Fight to Fight. When the Virginian planter George Washington arrived in Cambridge, he took up residence in a grand mansion, looking down with dismay on the prospective troops arrayed on the grounds. The Minutemen, he complained in a letter, were a mixed multitude and under very little discipline, order, or government. According to Leslie Brunetta of the Cambridge Black History Project, an organization working with the Cambridge Historical Commission and Harvard University, what most likely disturbed him was that white, black, and native officers, to say nothing of their rowdy camp followers, mingled below with no discernible boundaries or hierarchy. I think up until very recently, the mental picture was that all of these men were white, and there were maybe a few black men cooking or something, Miss Brunetta said. But it's very porous, and everyone was socializing. What Washington was seeing was not equality, but the peculiar brand of New England slavery. In towns such as Cambridge and Newport, enslavement took on a very different guise than it did on the plantations of the South. These were deeply domestic arrangements, in an upstairs-downstairs setting, where the black families were enmeshed and often related, as were the white families who enslaved them. Given differences in how the slave system operated in the North and in the South, black New Englanders were more willing to enlist black men. Southerners, however, were resolutely against arming captives, believing that black soldiers could not serve as courageously as white men. Washington issued a ruling. The army must not enlist any deserter, stroller, Negro, or vagabond, but only men of courage and principle. From the beginning, black soldiers had to fight to fight. The next part of the article is titled, Voices of the Revolution. In 1849, William Cooper Nell led what is believed to be the first major effort to uncover the history of black revolutionary soldiers. As a black reporter with The Liberator, an abolitionist newspaper, he conducted interviews, combed through newspaper notices, and reviewed court files to craft The Colored Patriots of the American Revolution. The Museum of African American History in Boston displayed an original copy of the book in its Black Voices of the Revolution exhibit, which opened in July 2025. The fragile 396 pages were held aloft on a stand. Wishing I could turn them, I thought how Nell must have had no idea it would be another century and a half before historians took up the topic again. Leafing through a gift shop copy, I learned that one soldier, Pompey Lovejoy, is the eponym for Pomp's Pond in Andover. My grandfather, who was shut out of pilot training in the 1940s and who fought in the Korean War, grew up swimming in Andover's ponds. I'm sure he never knew Pomp's was named for another black soldier. The exhibit also featured a life-size hologram of Frederick Douglass that draws from a database of Douglass's speeches and writings to answer questions using artificial intelligence. His booming voice was both arresting and slightly disconcerting, as Douglass, rendered like a Grand Theft Auto character in a frock coat, swayed gently. I thought of his famous quote from the speech, "What to the slave is the 4th of July?" Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought light and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice. I must mourn. The next part of the article is titled, Bundled Spirits. I came to Rhode Island a few weeks ahead of the tourist season to preview the new Newport Center for Black History, which opened on Juneteenth. Housed in the Wanton Lyman Hazard House, among the oldest homes in the city, the center focuses not only on slavery, but on what the director, Akia DeBarrios Gomes, calls Black Newport's freedom making. Chief among these types of displays is the museum's most precious item, a Nkisi, N-K-I-S-I, or spirit bundle that was discovered by a worker in the attic in 2005. Bundles have been found throughout the African diaspora, but this one is the first one unearthed in New England. Wrapped in checked fabric, it holds nails, shells, beads, even a pit, all objects with symbolic meaning to the owner. It is, Dr. DeBarrios Gomes said, proof of the continuance of African spirituality in this home, how people maintain their humanity in bondage. The bundle may have belonged to Cardardo Wanton, a revolutionary soldier enslaved here by the prosperous merchant and Quaker John Wanton. Under pressure from the church, Wanton manumitted Cardardo, but he kept him under guardianship, meaning he was free only in name. Cardardo, capital C-A-R-D-A-R-D-O, like so many, enlisted to gain his freedom. He served on a secret mission with the 1st Rhode Island Regiment, which, desperate for bodies, allowed black and native men to enlist and pay them the same as white soldiers. Dr. DeBarrios Gomes crafted brief and moving audio narratives based on archival research and historical papers of those enslaved in the home. I listened to Cardardo tell us why he chose to fight. I know the dangers. We'll take the hardest post, the bloodiest battles, but I'd rather die in the open air than live another year in chains. The next section is titled, Into the Woods. I wanted to be sure not to miss Sippo's Garden in Weetamoo Woods, a nature preserve in Tiverton, Rhode Island. Apparently, it was the home site of the revolutionary soldier Scipio Cook, where flowers from his garden still bloom. There is no mention of the site at the park's entrance or in the trail guide, but a friendly dog walker circled it for me on a map. I set off in the dusk. 5 minutes down a rocky path, I followed a small blue sign toward a beautiful place. The footprint of the house is evident in the tumble of stones, and a clearing is where the garden would have been. It is too early in the season for flowers, but I could hear the creek and occasional bird call, the wind settling in the trees. According to the definitive book on enslaved people in the region, If Jane Should Want to Be Sold by Marjorie Gomez O'Toole, Cook returned from war. In 1784, his enslaver granted him his freedom papers. Whether he purchased his freedom or was given it for his service isn't known. Cook and his family chose the Weetamoo Woods, W-E-E-T-A-M-O-O, because black people were increasingly unwelcome in Tiverton. The town had begun a campaign against transient blacks, directing homes they built to be torn down. The Cooks were only as free as the town allowed them to be. The next section is titled, Rethinking Thoreau. On a spring day, I drove to the Robbins House, a historic home that houses the Museum of Concord's Black History. During my visit, I learned about Brister Cumming, C-U-M-I-N-G, who was enslaved for about 30 years after he was given to John Cumming, a physician, when he was 9 years old. After fighting in the Revolution, he returned to Concord as Brister Freeman. With another veteran, he purchased land on the sandy soil near Walden Pond. That land allowed him to vote and speak at town meetings. Slowly, the town taxed him until it took the deed of the land back, and with it, his vote. But in an act of civil disobedience, he and his family refused to leave the land he had worked so hard to purchase. About half a century later, Henry David Thoreau settled in the Walden Woods along the edge of the pond. Freeman's homestead and community became an inspiration for Thoreau, who settled near the site and wrote in Walden about Brister's Hill and the legacy of the free man who lived there. The poet also chronicled drinking from Brister's spring and eating wild apples from the trees he had planted. I became consumed with Brister's story. It seemed inconceivable that a man featured in Walden, a mainstay of high school English, could remain so invisible for so long. Freeman and Concord's captives fought on and helped rebuild the North Bridge. Freeman is also believed to be the first man in Concord to refuse to pay his poll tax as an act of protest, an action that Thoreau would mimic decades later. This community of freed black people is inseparable from Concord's history. Yet Thoreau's legacy, honored by a gleaming National Park Service Center only steps away, has entirely eclipsed theirs. In 2023, Brister's home site was cleared by a high school student named Grady Flynn as part of an Eagle Scout project. A large heart-shaped piece of granite identifies where he and his wife, Finda, made their home. The stone is lightly touched by lichen. I walked down towards Brister's Spring, located on the Emerson Thoreau Amble. I had once thought such appellations, Brister's Spring, Pomp's Pond, Sippo's Garden, were signs of a community's affection. I now know they signify people who had not merited surnames. I missed the spring on my first pass, but turning around on the pine-strewn path, I saw a slim blue sign reading, Brister Spring, rising from a damp patch. I had found the spring, I realized with delight, untouched by tour bus or visitor center. It was precious in its isolation. But there is a point in which isolation can become obfuscation. Brister Spring, I could see, was alive and wild, filled with a history that is still bubbling, trying to reach the surface. That was the New York Times article titled, The Fight to Fight, Black Soldiers in the Revolutionary War. It was written by Lizzie Skernick and published July 2nd, 2026. That's all for this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcast or in the archives at the Audio Reader Network of the University of Kansas at the website reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.